pair of teeth ring together, just inches from my hand, and then I hear Peter cry out, feel the yank on his body, the heavy weight of Boy and Mutt pulling me over the side. If not for the grip on my arm, he'd be on the ground, but as it is, it takes all my strength to keep us both on the curved back of the horn. And more tributes are coming. Kill it, Peter! Kill it! I'm shouting, and although I can't quite see what's happening, I know he must have stabbed the thing, because the pull lessens. I'm able to haul him back onto the horn, where we drag ourselves toward the top, where the lesser of two evils awaits. Cato has still not regained his feet, but his breathing is slowing, and I know soon he'll be recovered enough to come for us, to hurl us over the side to our deaths. I arm my bow, but the arrow ends up taking out a Mutt that can only be Thresh. Who else could jump so high? I feel a moment's relief, because we must finally be up above the Mutt line, and I'm just turning back to face Cato when Peter's jerked from my side. I'm sure the pack has got him until his blood splatters my face. Cato stands before me, almost at the lip of the horn, holding Peter in some kind of headlock, cutting off his air. Peter's clawing at Cato's arm, but weakly, as if confused over whether it's more important to breathe or try and stem the gush of blood from the gaping hole a Mutt left in his calf. I aim one of my last two arrows at Cato's head, knowing it'll have no effect on his trunk or limbs, which I can now see are clothed in a skin-tight, flesh-colored mesh. Some high-grade body armor from the capital. Was that what was in his pack at the feast? Body armor to defend against my arrows. Well, they neglected to send a face guard. Cato just laughs. Shoot me and he goes down with me. He's right. If I take him out and he falls to the Mutts, Peter is sure to die with him. We've reached a stalemate. I can't shoot Cato without killing Peter, too. He can't kill Peter without guaranteeing an arrow in his brain. We stand like statues, both of us seeking an out. My muscles are strained so tightly, they feel they might snap at any moment. My teeth clenched to the breaking point. The Mutts go silent, and the only thing I can hear is the blood pounding in my good ear. Peter's lips are turning blue. If I don't do something quickly, he'll die of asphyxiation, and then I'll have lost him, and Cato will probably use his body as a weapon against me. In fact, I'm sure this is Cato's plan, because while he stopped laughing, his lips are set in a triumphant smile. As if in a last-ditch effort, Peter raises his fingers, dripping with blood from his leg, up to Cato's arm. Instead of trying to wrestle his way free, his forefinger veers off and makes a deliberate X on the back of Cato's hand. Cato realizes what it means exactly 1 second after I do. I can tell by the way the smile drops from his lips. But it's 1 second too late, because by that time, my arrow is piercing his hand. He cries out and reflexively releases Peter, who slams back against him. For a horrible moment, I think they're both going over. I dive forward, just catching hold of Peter, as Cato loses his footing on the blood-slick horn and plummets to the ground. We hear him hit, the air leaving his body on impact, and then the Mutts attack him. Peter and I hold on to each other, waiting for the cannon, waiting for the competition to finish, waiting to be released. But it doesn't happen. Not yet, because this is the climax of the Hunger Games and the audience expects a show. I don't watch, but I can hear the snarls, the growls, the howls of pain from both human and beast as Cato takes on the Mutt Pack. I can't understand how he can be surviving until I remember the body armor protecting him from ankle to neck, and I realize what a long night this could be. Cato must have a knife or sword or something, too, something he has hidden in his clothes, because on occasion there's the death scream of a Mutt, or the sound of metal on metal as the blade collides with the golden horn. The combat moves around the side of the cornucopia, and I know Cato must be attempting the one maneuver that could save his life, to make his way back around to the tail of the horn and rejoin us. But in the end, despite his remarkable strength and skill, he is simply overpowered. I don't know how long it has been, maybe an hour or so, when Cato hits the ground, and we hear the mutts dragging him back into the cornucopia. Now they'll finish him off, I think. But there's still no cannon. Night falls, and the anthem plays, and there's no picture of Cato in the sky, only the faint moans coming through the metal beneath us. The icy air blowing across the plain reminds me that the games are not over, and may not be for who knows how long, and there is still no guarantee of victory. I turn my attention to Peter, and discover his leg is bleeding as badly as ever. All our supplies, our packs, remain down by the lake where we abandoned them when we fled from the mutts. I have no bandage, nothing to staunch the flow of blood from his calf. Although I'm shaking in the biting wind, I rip off my jacket, remove my shirt, and zip back into the jacket as swiftly as possible. That brief exposure sets my teeth chattering beyond control. Peter's face is gray in the pale moonlight. I make him lie down before I probe his wound. Warm, slippery blood runs over my fingers. A bandage will not be enough. I've seen my mother tie a tourniquet a handful of times and try to replicate it. I cut free a sleeve from my shirt, wrap it twice around his leg just under his knee, and tie a half knot. I don't have a stick, so I take my remaining arrow and insert it in the knot, twisting it as tightly as I dare. It's risky business. Peter may end up losing his leg, but when I weigh this against him losing his life, what alternative do I have? I bandage the wound with the rest of my shirt and lay down with him. Don't go to sleep, I tell him. I'm not sure if this is exactly medical protocol, but I'm terrified that if he drifts off, he'll never wake again. Are you cold? He asks. He unzips his jacket, and I press against him as he fastens it around me. It's a bit warmer, sharing our body heat inside my double layer of jackets, but the night is young. The temperature will continue to drop. Even now I can feel the cornucopia, which burned so when I first climbed it, slowly turning to ice. Cato may win this thing yet, I whisper to Peter.
Don't you believe it,
he says, pulling up my hood, but he's shaking harder than I am. The next hours are the worst in my life, which, if you think about it, is saying something. The cold would be torture enough. But the real nightmare is listening to Cato, moaning, begging, and finally just whimpering as the mutts work away at him. After a very short time, I don't care who he is or what he's done. All I want is for his suffering to end. Why don't they just kill him? I ask Peter.
You know why,
he says, and pulls me closer to him. And I do. No viewer could turn away from the show now. From the game maker's point of view, this is the final word in entertainment. It goes on and on and on, and eventually completely consumes my mind, blocking out memories and hopes of tomorrow, erasing everything but the present, which I begin to believe will never change. There will never be anything but cold and fear, and the agonized sounds of the boy dying in the horn. Peter begins to doze off now, and each time he does, I find myself yelling his name louder and louder, because if he goes and dies on me now, I know I'll go completely insane. He's fighting it, probably more for me than for him, and it's hard because unconsciousness would be its own form of escape. But the adrenaline pumping through my body would never allow me to follow him, so I can't let him go. I just can't. The only indication of the passage of time lies in the heavens, the subtle shift of the moon. So Peter begins pointing it out to me, insisting I acknowledge its progress, and sometimes, For just a moment, I feel a flicker of hope, before the agony of the night engulfs me again. Finally, I hear him whisper that the sun is rising. I open my eyes and find the stars fading in the pale light of dawn. I can see, too, how bloodless Peter's face has become, how little time he has left, and I know I have to get him back to the capital. Still no cannon has fired. I press my good ear against the horn and can just make out Cato's voice.
I think he's closer now. Katniss, can you shoot him?
Peter asks. If he's near the mouth, I may be able to take him out. It would be an act of mercy at this point.
My last arrow's in your tourniquet, I say. Make it count, says Peter, unzipping his jacket, letting me loose.
So I free the arrow, tying the tourniquet back as tightly as my frozen fingers can manage. I rub my hands together, trying to regain circulation. When I crawl to the lip of the horn and hang over the edge, I feel Peter's hands grip me for support. It takes a few moments to find Cato in the dim light, in the blood. Then the raw hunk of meat that used to be my enemy makes a sound, and I know where his mouth is, and I think the word he's trying to say is, please. Pity, not vengeance, sends my arrow flying into his skull. Peter pulls me back up, bow in hand, quiver empty.
Did you get him?
He whispers. The cannon fires in answer.
Then we won, Katniss,
he says hollowly.
Hooray for us!
I get out, but there's no joy of victory in my voice. A hole opens in the plain, and as if on cue, the remaining mutts bound into it, disappearing as the earth closes above them. We wait for the hovercraft to take Cato's remains, for the trumpets of victory that should follow, but nothing happens.
Hey!
I shout into the air.
What's going on?
The only response is the chatter of waking birds.
Maybe it's the body. Maybe we have to move away from it, says Peter.
I try to remember. Do you have to distance yourself from the dead tribute on the final kill? My brain is too muddled to be sure, but what else could be the reason for the delay?
Okay. Think you could make it to the lake? I ask.
Think I'd better try, says Peter.
We inch down to the tail of the horn and fall to the ground. If the stiffness in my limbs is this bad, how can Peter even move? I rise first, swinging and bending my arms and legs until I think I can help him up. Somehow we make it back to the lake. I scoop up a handful of cold water for Peter and bring a second to my lips. A mockingjay gives the long, low whistle, and tears of relief fill my eyes as the hovercraft appears and takes Cato's body away. Now they will take us. Now we can go home. But again, there's no response.
What are they waiting for?
Says Peter weakly. Between the loss of the tourniquet and the effort it took to get to the lake, his wound has opened up again.
I don't know,
I say. Whatever the holdup is, I can't watch him lose any more blood. I get up and find a stick, but almost immediately come across the arrow that bounced off Cato's body armor. It will do as well as the other arrow. As I stoop to pick it up, Claudius Templesmith's voice booms into the arena.
Greetings to the final contestants of the 74th Hunger Games. The earlier revision has been revoked. Closer examination of the rule book has disclosed that only one winner may be allowed, he says. Good luck, and may the odds be ever in your favor.
There's a small burst of static, and then nothing more. I stare at Peter in disbelief as the truth sinks in. They never intended to let us both live. This has all been devised by the game makers to guarantee the most dramatic showdown in history, and like a fool, I bought into it.
If you think about it, it's not that surprising, he says softly. I watch as he painfully makes it to his feet. Then he's moving toward me, as if in slow motion. His hand is pulling the knife from his belt. Before I am even aware of my actions, my bow is loaded with the arrow pointed straight at his heart. Peter raises his eyebrows, and I see the knife has already left his hand on its way to the lake where it splashes in the water. I drop my weapon and take a step back, my face burning in what can only be shame.
No, he says. Do it.
Peter limps toward me and thrusts the weapons back in my hands.
I can't, I say. I won't.
Do it before they send those mutts back or something. I don't want to die like Cato, he says.
Then you shoot me, I say furiously, shoving the weapons back at him. You shoot me and go home and live with it. And I say it. I know death right here, right now, would be the easier of the two.
You know I can't,
Peter says, discarding the weapons.
Fine. I'll go first anyway.
He leans down and rips the bandage off his leg, eliminating the final barrier between his blood and the earth.
No, you can't kill yourself,
I say. I'm on my knees, desperately, plastering the bandage back onto his wound.
Katniss, he says, it's what I want.
You're not leaving me here alone, I say, because if he dies, I'll never go home, not really. I'll spend the rest of my life in this arena, trying to think my way out.
Listen, he says, pulling me to my feet. We both know they have to have a victor. It can only be one of us. Please, take it. For me.
And he goes on about how he loves me, what life would be without me, but I stopped listening, because his previous words are trapped in my head, thrashing desperately around.
We both know they have to have a victor.
Yes, they have to have a victor. Without a victor, the whole thing would blow up in the game makers' faces. They'd have failed the capital, might possibly even be executed slowly and painfully while the cameras broadcast it to every screen in the country. If Peter and I were both to die, or they thought we were... My fingers fumble with the pouch on my belt, freeing it.
Peter sees it, and his hand clamps on my wrist. No, I won't let you.
Trust me, I whisper. He holds my gaze for a long moment, then lets me go. I loosen the top of the pouch and pour a few spoonfuls of berries into his palm. Then I fill my own.
On the count of three?
Peter leans down and kisses me once, very gently.
The count of three, he says.
We stand, our backs pressed together, our empty hands locked tight.
Hold them out. I want everyone to see, he says.
I spread out my fingers, and the dark berries glisten in the sun. I give Peter's hand one last squeeze as a signal, as a goodbye, and we begin counting.
One? Maybe I'm wrong.
Two?
Maybe they don't care if we both die.
Three? It's too late to change my mind. I lift my hand to my mouth, taking one last look at the world. The berries have just passed my lips when the trumpets begin to blare. The frantic voice of Claudius Templesmith shouts above them,
Stop! Stop! Ladies and gentlemen, I am pleased to present the victors of the 74th Hunger Games, Katniss Everdeen and Peter Mellark. I give you the tributes of District 12.
Chapter 26. I spew the berries from my mouth, wiping my tongue with the end of my shirt to make sure no juice remains. Peeta pulls me to the lake, where we both flush our mouths with water and then collapse into each other's arms.
You didn't swallow any?
I ask him. He shakes his head.
You?
Guess I'd be dead by now if I did, I say. I can see his lips moving in reply, but I can't hear him over the roar of the crowd in the capital that they're playing live over the speakers. The hovercraft materializes overhead, and two ladders drop, only there's no way I'm letting go of Peeta. I keep one arm around him as I help him up, and we each place a foot on the first rung of the ladder. The electric current freezes us in place, and this time I'm glad, because I'm not really sure Peeta can hang on for the whole ride. And since my eyes were looking down, I can see that while our muscles are immobile, nothing is preventing the blood from draining out of Peeta's leg. Sure enough, the minute the door closes behind us and the current stops, he slumps to the floor, unconscious. My fingers are still gripping the back of his jacket so tightly that when they take him away, it tears, leaving me with a fistful of black fabric. Doctors in sterile white, masked and gloved, already prepped to operate, go into action. Peeta's so pale and still on a silver table, tubes and wires springing out of him every which way, and for a moment I forget we're out of the games, and I see the doctors as just one more threat, one more pack of mutts designed to kill him. Petrified, I lunge for him, but I'm caught and thrust back into another room, and a glass door seals between us. I pound on the glass, screaming my head off. Everyone ignores me, except for some capital attendant who appears behind me and offers me a beverage. I slump down on the floor, my face against the door, staring uncomprehendingly at the crystal glass in my hand. Icy cold, filled with orange juice, a straw with a frilly white collar. How wrong it looks in my bloody, filthy hand, with its dirt-caked nails and scars. My mouth waters at the smell, but I place it carefully on the floor, not trusting anything so clean and pretty. Through the glass, I see the doctors working feverishly on Peeta, their brows creased in concentration. I see the flow of liquids, pumping through the tubes, watch a wall of dials and lights that mean nothing to me. I'm not sure, but I think his heart stops twice. It's like being home again, when they bring in the hopelessly mangled person from the mine explosion, or the woman in her third day of labor, or the famished child struggling against pneumonia, and my mother and Prim. They wear that same look on their faces. Now is the time to run away to the woods, to hide in the trees until the patient is long gone, and in another part of the seam, the hammers make the coffin. But I'm held here, both by the hovercraft walls and the same force that holds the loved ones of the dying. How often I've seen them, ringed round our kitchen table, and I thought, why don't they leave? Why do they stay to watch? And now I know. It's because you have no choice. I startle when I catch someone staring at me from only a few inches away, and then realize it's my own face reflecting back in the glass. Wild eyes, hollow cheeks, my hair in a tangled mat, rabid, feral, mad. No wonder everyone is keeping a safe distance from me. The next thing I know, we've landed back on the roof of the training center, and they're taking Peeta, but leaving me behind the door. I start hurling myself against the glass, shrieking, and I think I just catch a glimpse of pink hair. It must be Effie. It has to be Effie, coming to my rescue, when the needle jabs me from behind. When I wake, I'm afraid to move at first. The entire ceiling glows with a soft yellow light, allowing me to see that I'm in a room containing just my bed.
No doors, no windows are visible. The air smells of something sharp and antiseptic. My right arm has several tubes that extend into the wall behind me. I'm naked, but the bedclothes are soothing against my skin. I tentatively lift my left hand above the cover. Not only has it been scrubbed clean, the nails are filed in perfect ovals. The scars from the burns are less prominent. I touch my cheek, my lips, the puckered scar above my eyebrow, and am just running my fingers through my silken hair when I freeze. Apprehensively, I ruffle the hair by my left ear. No, it wasn't an illusion. I can hear again. I try and sit up, but some sort of wide restraining band around my waist keeps me from rising more than a few inches. The physical confinement makes me panic, and I'm trying to pull myself up and wriggle my hips through the band when a portion of the wall slides open and in steps the red-headed Avox girl carrying a tray. The sight of her calms me, and I stop trying to escape. I want to ask her a million questions, but I'm afraid any familiarity would cause her harm. Obviously, I am being closely monitored. She sets the tray across my thighs and presses something that raises me to a sitting position. While she adjusts my pillows, I risk one question. I say it out loud, as clearly as my rusty voice will allow, so nothing will seem secretive. Did Peter make it? She gives me a nod, and as she slips a spoon into my hand, I feel the pressure of friendship. I guess she did not wish me dead after all. And Peter has made it. Of course he did, with all their expensive equipment here. Still, I hadn't been sure until now. As the Avox leaves, the door closes noiselessly after her, and I turn hungrily to the tray. A bowl of clear broth, a small serving of applesauce, and a glass of water. This is it? I think grouchily. Shouldn't my homecoming dinner be a little more spectacular? But I find it's an effort to finish the spare meal before me. My stomach seems to have shrunk to the size of a chestnut, and I have to wonder how long I've been out, because I had no trouble eating a fairly sizable breakfast that last morning in the arena. There's usually a lag of a few days between the end of the competition and the presentation of the victor, so that they can put the starving, wounded mess of a person back together again. Somewhere, Cinna and Portia will be creating our wardrobes for the public appearances. Haymitch and Effie will be arranging the banquet for our sponsors, reviewing the questions for our final interviews. Back home, District 12 is probably in chaos as they try and organize the homecoming celebrations for Peter and me, given that the last one was close to 30 years ago. Home. Prim and my mother. Gale. Even the thought of Prim's scruffy old cat makes me smile. Soon I will be home. I want to get out of this bed, to see Peter and Cinna, to find out more about what's been going on. And why shouldn't I? I feel fine. But as I start to work my way out of the band, I feel a cold liquid seeping into my vein from one of the tubes and almost immediately lose consciousness. This happens on and off for an indeterminate amount of time. My waking, eating, and even though I resist the impulse to try and escape the bed, being knocked out again. I seem to be in a strange, continual twilight. Only a few things register. The red-headed Avox girl has not returned since the feeding. My scars are disappearing, and do I imagine it? Or do I hear a man's voice yelling? Not in the capital accent, but in the rougher cadences of home. And I can't help having a vague, comforting feeling that someone is looking out for me. Then, finally, the time arrives when I come to, and there's nothing plugged into my right arm. The restraint around my middle has been removed, and I'm free to move about. I start to sit up, but am arrested by the sight of my hands. The skin's perfection, smooth and glowing. Not only are the scars from the arena gone, but those accumulated over years of hunting have vanished without a trace. My forehead feels like satin, and when I try to find the burn on my calf, there's nothing. I slip my legs out of bed, nervous about how they will bear my weight, and find them strong and steady. Lying at the foot of the bed is an outfit that makes me flinch. It's what all of the tributes wore in the arena. I stare at it as if it had teeth, until I remember that, of course, this is what I will wear to greet my team. I'm dressed in less than a minute and fidgeting in front of the wall where I know there's a door, even if I can't see it, when suddenly it slides open. I step into a wide, deserted hall that appears to have no other doors on it. But it must, and behind one of them must be Peeta. Now that I'm conscious and moving, I'm growing more and more anxious about him. He must be all right, or the Avox girl wouldn't have said so. But I need to see him for myself. Peeta! I call out, since there's no one to ask. I hear my name in response, but it's not his voice. It's the voice that provokes first irritation and then eagerness. Effie. I turn and see them all waiting in a big chamber at the end of the hall. Effie, Haymitch, and Cinna. My feet take off without hesitation. Maybe a victor should show more restraint, more superiority, especially when she knows this will be on tape, but I don't care. I run for them and surprise even myself when I launch into Haymitch's arms first, when he whispers in my ear, "Nice job, sweetheart." It doesn't sound sarcastic. Effie's somewhat teary and keeps patting my hair and talking about how she told everyone we were pearls. Cinna just hugs me tight and doesn't say anything. Then I notice Portia is absent and get a bad feeling. Where's Portia? Is she with Peeta? He is all right, isn't he? I mean, he's alive, I blurt out.
He's fine, only they want to do your reunion live on air at the ceremony, says Haymitch.
Oh, that's all, I say. The awful moment of thinking Peeta's dead again passes. I guess I'd want to see that myself.
Go on with Cinna. He has to get you ready, says Haymitch.
It's a relief to be alone with Cinna, to feel his protective arm around my shoulders as he guides me away from the cameras, down a few passages, and to an elevator that leads to the lobby of the training center. The hospital, then, is far underground, even beneath the gym where the tributes practiced tying knots and throwing spears. The windows of the lobby are darkened, and a handful of guards stand on duty. No one else is there to see us cross to the tribute elevator. Our footsteps echo in the emptiness. And when we ride up to the 12th floor, the faces of all the tributes who will never return flash across my mind, and there's a heavy, tight place in my chest. When the elevator doors open, Venia, Flavius, and Octavia engulf me, talking so quickly and ecstatically I can't make out their words. The sentiment is clear, though. They are truly thrilled to see me, and I'm happy to see them, too, although not like I was to see Cinna. It's more in the way one might be glad to see an affectionate trio of pets at the end of a particularly difficult day. They sweep me into the dining room, and I get a real meal, roast beef and peas and soft rolls, although my portions are still being strictly controlled, because when I ask for seconds, I'm refused.
"No, no, no, they don't want it all coming back up on the stage," says Octavia,
but she secretly slips me an extra roll under the table to let me know she's on my side. We go back to my room, and Cinna disappears for a while as the prep team gets me ready.
"Oh, they did a full body polish on you," says Flavius enviously. "Not a flaw left on your skin."
But when I look at my naked body in the mirror, all I can see is how skinny I am. I mean, I'm sure I was worse when I came out of the arena, but I can easily count my ribs. They take care of the shower settings for me, and they go to work on my hair, nails, and makeup when I'm done. They chatter so continuously
that I barely have to reply, which is good, since I don't feel very talkative. It's funny, because even though they're rattling on about the games, it's all about where they were and what they were doing or how they felt when a specific event occurred. I was still in bed. I had just had my eyebrows dyed.
I swear I nearly fainted.
Everything is about them, not the dying boys and girls in the arena. We don't wallow around in the games this way in District 12. We grit our teeth and watch because we must, and try to get back to business as soon as possible when they're over. To keep from hating the prep team, I effectively tune out most of what they're saying. Cinna comes in with what appears to be an unassuming yellow dress across his arms. "Have you given up the whole girl on fire thing?" I ask. "You tell me," he says, and slips it over my head. I immediately notice the padding over my breasts, adding curves that the hunger has stolen from my body. My hands go to my chest, and I frown.
"I know," says Cinna before I can object, "but the game makers wanted to alter you surgically. Haymitch had a huge fight with them over it. This was the compromise."
He stops me before I can look at my reflection. "Wait, don't forget the shoes." Venia helps me into a pair of flat leather sandals, and I turn to the mirror. I am still the girl on fire. The sheer fabric softly glows. Even the slight movement in the air sends a ripple up my body. By comparison, the chariot costume seems garish. The interview dress too contrived. In this dress, I give the illusion of wearing candlelight.
"What do you think?" asks Cinna.
"I think it's the best yet," I say. When I manage to pull my eyes away from the flickering fabric, I'm in for something of a shock. My hair's loose, held back by a simple hairband. The makeup rounds and fills out the sharp angles of my face. A clear polish coats my nails. The sleeveless dress is gathered at my ribs, not my waist, largely eliminating any help the padding would have given my figure. The hem falls just to my knees. Without heels, you can see my true stature. I look, very simply, like a girl, a young one, 14 at the most, innocent, harmless. Yes, it is shocking that Cinna has pulled this off when you remember I've just won the games. This is a very calculated look. Nothing Cinna designs is arbitrary. I bite my lip trying to figure out his motivation. "I thought it'd be something more sophisticated looking," I say. "I thought Peter would like this better." He answers carefully. "Peter? No, it's not about Peter. It's about the capital and the game makers and the audience." Although I do not yet understand Cinna's design, it's a reminder the games are not quite finished. And beneath his benign reply, I sense a warning of something he can't even mention in front of his own team. We take the elevator to the level where we trained. It's customary for the victor and his or her support team to rise from beneath the stage. First, the prep team, followed by the escort, the stylist, the mentor, and finally, the victor. Only this year, with two victors who both share an escort and a mentor, the whole thing has had to be rethought. I find myself in a poorly lit area under the stage. A brand new metal plate has been installed to transport me upward. You can still see small piles of sawdust, smell fresh paint. Cinna and the prep team peel off to change into their own costumes and take their positions, leaving me alone. In the gloom, I see a makeshift wall about 10 yards away and assume Peter's behind it. The rumbling of the crowd is loud, so I don't notice Haymitch until he touches my shoulder. I spring away, startled, still half in the arena, I guess.
"Easy, just me.
Let's have a look at you," Haymitch says. I hold out my arms and turn once.
"Good enough."
It's not much of a compliment. "But what?" I say. Haymitch's eyes shift around my musty holding space, and he seems to make a decision.
"But nothing. How about a hug for luck?
Okay, that's an odd request from Haymitch, but after all, we are victors. Maybe a hug for luck is in order. Only when I put my arms around his neck, I find myself trapped in his embrace. He begins talking very fast, very quietly in my ear, my hair concealing his lips.
Listen up. You're in trouble. Word is the capital's furious about you showing them up in the arena. The one thing they can't stand is being laughed at, and they're the joke of Panem, says Haymitch.
I feel dread coursing through me now, but I laugh as though Haymitch is saying something completely delightful, because nothing is covering my mouth.
So what?
Your only defense can be you were so madly in love you weren't responsible for your actions.
Haymitch pulls back and adjusts my hairband.
Got it, sweetheart?
He could be talking about anything now.
Got it, I say. Did you tell Peter this?
Don't have to, says Haymitch. He's already there.
But you think I'm not, I say, taking the opportunity to straighten a bright red bow tie Cinna must have wrestled him into.
Since when does it matter what I think? Says Haymitch. Better take our places.
He leads me to the metal circle.
This is your night, sweetheart. Enjoy it.
He kisses me on the forehead and disappears into the gloom. I tug on my skirt, willing it to be longer, wanting it to cover the knocking in my knees. Then I realize it's pointless. My whole body's shaking like a leaf. Hopefully, it will be put down to excitement. After all, it's my night. The damp, moldy smell beneath the stage threatens to choke me. A cold, clammy sweat breaks out on my skin, and I can't rid myself of the feeling that the boards above my head are about to collapse, to bury me alive under the rubble. When I left the arena, when the trumpets played, I was supposed to be safe. From then on, for the rest of my life. But if what Haymitch says is true, and he's got no reason to lie, I've never been in such a dangerous place in my life. It's so much worse than being hunted in the arena. There, I could only die, end of story. But out here, Prim, my mother, Gale, the people of District 12, everyone I care about back home could be punished if I can't pull off the girl-driven crazy-by-love scenario Haymitch has suggested. So I still have a chance, though. Funny, in the arena, when I poured out those berries, I was only thinking of outsmarting the game-makers, not how my actions would reflect on the capital. But the Hunger Games are their weapon, and you are not supposed to be able to defeat it. So now the capital will act as if they've been in control the whole time, as if they orchestrated the whole event, right down to the double suicide. But that will only work if I play along with them. And Peter will suffer too, if this goes wrong. But what was it Haymitch said when I asked if he had told Peter the situation? That he had to pretend to be desperately in love.
Don't have to. He's already there.
Already thinking ahead of me in the games again? Or well aware of the danger we're in? Or already desperately in love? I don't know. I haven't even begun to separate out my feelings about Peter. It's too complicated. What I did as part of the games, as opposed to what I did out of anger at the Capitol, or because of how it would be viewed back in District 12, or simply because it was the only decent thing to do, or what I did because I cared about him. These are questions to be unraveled back home in the peace and quiet of the woods, when no one is watching, not here with every eye upon me. But I won't have that luxury for who knows how long. And right now, the most dangerous part of the Hunger Games is about to begin.
Chapter 27.
The anthem booms in my ears, and then I hear Caesar Flickerman greeting the audience. Does he know how crucial it is to get every word right from now on? He must. He will want to help us.
The crowd breaks into applause as the prep teams are presented. I imagine Flavius, Venia, and Octavia bouncing around and taking ridiculous, bobbing bows. It's a safe bet. They're clueless. Then Effie's introduced. How long she's waited for this moment. I hope she's able to enjoy it, because as misguided as Effie can be, she has a very keen instinct about certain things and must at least suspect we're in trouble. Portia and Cinna receive huge cheers, of course. They've been brilliant, had a dazzling debut. I now understand Cinna's choice of dress for me for tonight. I'll need to look as girlish and innocent as possible. Haymitch's appearance brings a round of stomping that goes on at least 5 minutes. Well, he's accomplished a first, keeping not only one but two tributes alive. What if he hadn't warned me in time? Would I have acted differently? Flaunted the moment with the berries in the capital's face? No, I don't think so. But I could easily have been a lot less convincing than I need to be now. Right now, because I can feel the plate lifting me up to the stage. Blinding light, the deafening roar rattles the metal under my feet. Then there's Peter just a few yards away. He looks so clean and healthy and beautiful. I can hardly recognize him, but his smile is the same whether in mud or in the capital, and when I see it, I take about 3 steps and fling myself into his arms. He staggers back, almost losing his balance, and that's when I realize the slim, metal contraption in his hand is some kind of cane. He rights himself, and we just cling to each other while the audience goes insane. He's kissing me, and all the time I'm thinking, do you know? Do you know how much danger we're in? After about 10 minutes of this, Caesar Flickerman taps on his shoulder to continue the show, and Peter just pushes him aside without even glancing at him. The audience goes berserk. Whether he knows or not, Peter is, as usual, playing the crowd exactly right. Finally, Haymitch interrupts us and gives us a good-natured shove toward the victor's chair. Usually, this is a single ornate chair from which the winning tribute watches a film of the highlights of the games, but since there are 2 of us, the game makers have provided a plush red velvet couch. A small one. My mother would call it a love seat, I think. I sit so close to Peter that I'm practically on his lap, but one look from Haymitch tells me it isn't enough. Kicking off my sandals, I tuck my feet to the side and lean my head against Peter's shoulder. His arm goes around me automatically, and I feel like I'm back in the cave, curled up against him, trying to keep warm. His shirt is made of the same yellow material as my dress, but Portia's put him in long black pants. No sandals either, but a pair of sturdy black boots he keeps solidly planted on the stage. I wish Cinna had given me a similar outfit. I feel so vulnerable in this flimsy dress, but I guess that was the point. Caesar Flickerman makes a few more jokes, and then it's time for the show. This will last exactly 3 hours and is required viewing for all of Panem. As the lights dim and the seal appears on the screen, I realize I'm unprepared for this. I do not want to watch my 22 fellow tributes die. I saw enough of them die the first time. My heart starts pounding, and I have a strong impulse to run. How have the other victors faced this alone? During the highlights, they periodically show the winners' reactions up on a box in the corner of the screen. I think back to earlier years. Some are triumphant, pumping their fists in the air, beating their chests. Most just seem stunned. All I know is that the only thing keeping me on this love seat is Peter, his arm around my shoulder, his other hand claimed by both of mine. Of course, the previous victors didn't have the capital looking for a way to destroy them. Condensing several weeks into 3 hours is quite a feat, especially when you consider how many cameras were going at once. Whoever put together the highlights has to choose what sort of story to tell. This year, for the first time, they tell a love story. I know Peter and I won, but a disproportionate amount of time is spent on us.
right from the beginning. I'm glad, though, because it supports the whole crazy-in-love thing that's my defense for defying the capital. Plus, it means we won't have as much time to linger over the deaths. The first half-hour or so focuses on the pre-arena events, the reaping, the chariot ride through the capital, our training scores, and our interviews. There's this sort of upbeat soundtrack playing under it that makes it twice as awful because, of course, almost everyone on screen is dead. Once we're in the arena, there's detailed coverage of the bloodbath, and then the filmmakers basically alternate between shots of tributes dying and shots of us. Mostly Peeta, really. There's no question. He's carrying this romance thing on his shoulders. Now I see what the audience saw. How he misled the careers about me, stayed awake the entire night under the tracker-jacker tree, fought Cato to let me escape, and even while he lay in that mud bank, whispered my name in his sleep. I seem heartless in comparison, dodging fireballs, dropping nests, and blowing up supplies, until I go hunting for Rue. They play her death in full, the spearing, my failed rescue attempt, my arrow through the boy from District 1's throat, Rue drawing her last breath in my arms. And the song. I get to sing every note of the song. Something inside me shuts down, and I'm too numb to feel anything. It's like watching complete strangers in another Hunger Games. But I do notice they omit the part where I covered her in flowers. Right. Because even that smacks of rebellion. Things pick up for me once they've announced two tributes from the same district can live, and I shout out Peeta's name and then clap my hands over my mouth. If I've seemed indifferent to him earlier, I make up for it now by finding him, nursing him back to health, going to the feast for the medicine, and being very free with my kisses. Objectively, I can see the Mutt's and Cato's death are as gruesome as ever, but again, I feel it happens to people I have never met. And then comes the moment with the berries. I can hear the audience hushing one another, not wanting to miss anything. A wave of gratitude to the filmmakers sweeps over me when they end, not with the announcement of our victory, but with me pounding on the glass door of the hovercraft, screaming Peeta's name as they try to revive him. In terms of survival, it's my best moment all night. The anthem's playing yet again, and we rise as President Snow himself takes the stage, followed by a little girl carrying a cushion that holds the crown. There's just one crown, though, and you can hear the crowd's confusion. Whose head will he place it on? Until President Snow gives it a twist, and it separates into two halves. He places the first around Peeta's brow with a smile. He's still smiling when he settles the second on my head, but his eyes, just inches from mine, are as unforgiving as a snake's. That's when I know that even though both of us would have eaten the berries, I am to blame for having the idea. I'm the instigator. I'm the one to be punished. Much bowing and cheering follows. My arm is about to fall off from waving when Caesar Flickerman finally bids the audience good night, reminding them to tune in tomorrow for the final interviews, as if they have a choice. Peeta and I are whisked to the president's mansion for the victory banquet, where we have very little time to eat as capital officials and particularly generous sponsors elbow one another out of the way as they try to get their picture with us. Face after beaming face flashes by, becoming increasingly intoxicated as the evening wears on. Occasionally, I catch a glimpse of Haymitch, which is reassuring, or President Snow, which is terrifying. But I keep laughing and thanking people, and smiling as my picture is taken. The one thing I never do is let go of Peeta's hand. The sun is just peeking over the horizon when we straggle back to the 12th floor of the training center. I think now I'll finally get a word alone with Peeta, but Haymitch sends him off with Portia to get something fitted for the interview and personally escorts me to my door. Why can't I talk to him? I ask.
Plenty of time to talk when we get home, says Haymitch. Go to bed. You're on air at 2.
Despite Haymitch's running interference, I'm determined to see Peeta privately. After I toss and turn for a few hours, I slip into the hall. My first thought is to check the roof, but it's empty. Even the city streets far below are deserted after the celebration last night. I go back to bed for a while, and then decide to go directly to his room. But when I try to turn the knob, I find my own bedroom door has been locked from the outside. I suspect Haymitch initially, but then there's a more insidious fear that the capital may be monitoring and confining me. I've been unable to escape since the Hunger Games began, but this feels different, much more personal. This feels like I've been imprisoned for a crime, and I'm awaiting sentencing. I quickly get back in bed and pretend to sleep until Effie Trinket comes to alert me to the start of another big, big, big day. I have about 5 minutes to eat a bowl of hot grain and stew before the prep team descends. All I have to say is, the crowd loved you, and it's unnecessary to speak for the next couple of hours. When Cinna comes in, he shoos them out and dresses me in a white gauzy dress and pink shoes. Then he personally adjusts my makeup until I seem to radiate a soft, rosy glow. We make idle chit-chat, but I'm afraid to ask him anything of real importance because after the incident with the door, I can't shake the feeling that I'm being watched constantly. The interview takes place right down the hall in the sitting room. A space has been cleared, and the love seat has been moved in and surrounded by vases of red and pink roses. There are only a handful of cameras to record the event, no live audience at least. Caesar Flickerman gives me a warm hug when I come in.
Congratulations, Katniss. How are you faring?
Fine. Nervous about the interview, I say.
Don't be. We're going to have a fabulous time,
he says, giving my cheek a reassuring pat. I'm not good at talking about myself, I say.
Nothing you say will be wrong, he says.
And I think, oh, Caesar, if only that were true. But actually, President Snow may be arranging some sort of accident for me as we speak. Then Pete is there looking handsome in red and white, pulling me off to the side. I hardly get to see you. Haymitch seems bent on keeping us apart. Haymitch is actually bent on keeping us alive, but there are too many ears listening, so I just say, yes, he's gotten very responsible lately.
Well, there's just this, and we go home. Then he can't watch us all the time, says Peeta.
I feel a sort of shiver run through me, and there's no time to analyze why, because they're ready for us. We sit somewhat formally on the love seat, but Caesar says,
oh, go ahead and curl up next to him if you want. It looked very sweet.
So I tuck my feet up, and Peeta pulls me in close to him. Someone counts backward, and just like that, we're being broadcast live to the entire country. Caesar Flickerman is wonderful, teasing, joking, getting choked up when the occasion presents itself. He and Peeta already have the rapport they established that night of the first interview, that easy banter, so I just smile a lot and try to speak as little as possible. I mean, I have to talk some, but as soon as I can, I redirect the conversation back to Peeta. Eventually, though, Caesar begins to pose questions that insist on fuller answers.
Well, Peeta, we know from our days in the cave that it was love at first sight for you from what, age 5?
Caesar says.
From the moment I laid eyes on her, says Peeta. But Katniss, what a ride for you. I think the real excitement for the audience was watching you fall for him. When did you realize you were in love with him? Asks Caesar.
Oh, that's a hard one. I give a faint, breathy laugh and look down at my hands. Help.
Well, I know when it hit me. The night when you shouted out his name from that tree, says Caesar.
Thank you, Caesar, I think, and then go with his idea. Yes, I guess that was it. I mean, until that point, I just tried not to think about what my feelings might be, honestly. Because it was so confusing, and it only made things worse if I actually cared about him. But then, in the tree, everything changed, I say.
Why do you